we do we think it's been a good 6 months of the year?
It's been a stressful 6 months.
It has been a stressful six
lots
months.
Lots happened.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, I think based on the tariff news and the Middle East disruption, it's one of those, again, if you'd been told what the news was going to be, you'd have sold everything.
Mm-hmm. And you'd be hiding in gold.
And you'd be, yeah, which wouldn't have been a bad thing, but you wouldn't have said markets would be virtually at all-time highs again. It's the resilience, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, should we get cracking?
Yep, go on.
Good. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 52. Hughesy and I are here to talk about the first half of the year, which, as you just may have gathered, or as you've had your head buried in the sand, has been a pretty lively one. So we've got some charts. We've got some talking points, and we will we'll fire away. And obviously, any questions as by way of follow up, then get in touch. Happy to chat and discuss.
Yeah.
But should we get started?
Let's go.
All right. So the first chart we'll just put up here, Hughesy, is these three sort of MSCI indices that we use as a matter of course. We've got the balanced growth and conservative indices, and they're just sort of multi-asset kind of benchmarks that we kind of look at. They're all up about 3%, weirdly.
Yeah.
But as the chart shows, the yellow line here is the growth portfolio, which is the index with the higher equity allocation. And then we've got the balanced in blue and the conservative in grey. And as you can see, the conservative index was the one that fell the least in April on so-called Liberation Day, but they've all ended the half year pretty much banging around at 3%. What's interesting is if you basically take 6 months at 3% and you double it, you get a 6% return, which is all right, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you'd probably take that. I think what is quite healthy is that the more defensive strategies, so the conservative in that sell-off, have done what they should have done, which is they've held up better. Obviously, 2022, that wasn't the case because bond pricing, particularly at the longer end, aggressively sold off. So this sort of, I think bonds, there's been a lot of talk about bonds and equities being closely correlated, and actually there has been some negative correlation, which is good. So those more defensive strategies have done what they should have done. So I think that's quite an important thing to, or message to get across to clients.
Yeah, we can see that in the January and February. Obviously, yeah. The year started off really strongly, which I think is what made the Liberation Day setback even worse, was not the fact that we were down 10% from December, was the fact that we'd been up 5%. So had you started with £100, at the end of January, early February, you were up at 105. And then in the midst of Liberation Day, if you were in a growth portfolio, you were down at 91.
Yeah,
so that was quite a meaningful setback. You know, peak to trough for the growth strategy or index, I should say, was, you know, nearly 15%, right? Which is not, we don't have those every day of the week.
No, and I think there were some difficult conversations with clients, just in terms of, you know, not with everyone, but with some sort of, you know, rightly being concerned about what the tariffs meant. You know, and the businesses we're investing in, when we're talking to, we're finding it very difficult to price in what the tariffs meant to their own revenue and profit lines, let alone, you know, from where we sit, what the implications are going to be at a headline level. So, you know, we obviously had that quick reverse, didn't we, in terms of the pause on tariffs, which is still paused at the moment. We can talk probably a bit more about that in a minute. You know, the equity market has been very resilient.
Yes.
It's quite, as I said before we started recording, you know, if you've been told what the news was going to be this year, but, you know, you probably would have sold your equity weightings, I would have thought, and it would have been completely the wrong thing to do. So
yeah, strong bounce back.
Well, we've got the market again.
We've got some equity indices here by way of example, and in January, when we were sat here during a view of 2024, we were talking about American exceptionalism, weren't we?
Yeah.
And why Europe and the UK and everything else was rubbish and just sell everything and buy the US. Well, lo and behold, we sit here 6 months later and European equities are the stars of the show, up 15.5%. These are all in sterling and total return, including on dividends. UK equities up just short of 10%, emerging market 6%, and the laggard is the US. And if you bought US equities on the 31st of December last year, you would be down 2% so far, mainly as a result of currency. So sterling has strengthened quite meaningfully against the dollar. But actually at the lows, you were down nearly 20% on your US equity allocation. So they were, you know,
well, really we were officially in a bear market, weren't we?
We were, yeah.
And now we're officially in a bull market. So.
Well, who knows? But I think you know, talking about what's happened, it's not just the trade stuff and the tariffs, but the kind of, you know, J.D. Vance standing up at Munich telling the Europeans that they need to start spending their own money on securing themselves did put a bit of a rocket up European politicians, and hence we've got the Germans promising to spend the best part of €1 trillion on infrastructure and defence, and European equities have done very well, led by the defence sector. I haven't got a chart of European defence sector. I wish I did, because it looks like incredible. Some sort of meme stock / cryptocurrency that's gone mad.
I mean, the other side, though, is obviously what the Germans have done on the fiscal deficit, and in terms of their borrowings, is enabling. They've essentially made the decision that they're going to increase borrowing in order to invest, and I think the market's got quite excited about that, hasn't it? It's pretty meaningful, and you know, our view is, you know, it's a longer term theme that could be quite powerful over the next decade. It's not something that's going to happen immediately, but you know, it will be beneficial to lots of companies listed in Europe, you know, starting with defence, but also infrastructure exposed as well. So.
Yeah, well, the industrial sector, I think, is one of the biggest sectors in Europe, aside from the banks. And banks and industrials are kind of classic cyclical plays, aren't they? So when the economy does better, GDP is higher, and there's a bit more activity, then those sectors are the one that tend to benefit the most. And yeah, European banks have been on a tear. European industrials, you know, stocks like Siemens and Schneider and the like have been very, very strong. So and as aside from the pure defence names, Rheinmetall, Saab, Leonardo in Italy, is a few stocks that are up 200-400% so far year to date. And in the UK it's been okay as well, despite typically when sterling goes up, the FTSE doesn't do particularly well because of all the international earnings. But actually, it's been all right. I mean, you know, BP and Shell have been fine, which are the oil majors, and then Astra's been okay-ish, and the banks have been good.
Yeah,
industrials have been fine.
I mean, we've been talking about this for a long time, but you know, we've spoken about US exceptionalism, but also have said, you know, the valuations of US businesses are more expensive than Europe and the UK. It was, you know, what is going to be the catalyst for UK and European markets to rebound? And, you know, we're looking for, there's sort of been, it's twofold, isn't it? It's the positivity coming out of Europe in terms of, you know, the increase in borrowings that we've spoken about, and also the requirement to spend more on defence. But on the other side, it's, from a global basis, there has been some shift away from US equities. You know, nothing major, but it doesn't take much. And, you know, if you're a global asset allocator, you are for the first time looking at other regions away from the US, because you have to.
Yeah, I got a chart here of the dollar, which is kind of part of that story, isn't
it? Indeed.
So this is the dollar index, DXY, and it's been, you know, it's been strong for 10, 20 years, but we have seen a really meaningful fall in the dollar against all currencies. Not just sterling, but also the euro and the yen. And if you're a global asset allocator, if you're sitting in those rooms around the world and you're deciding to put more money or less money into the US, well, if the currency's going against you, you're probably not going to put any more money in, are you?
No.
So there is a sort of, say, question mark. And you're right about the flows. Some of them, they have slowed, and there's been some hedging, currency hedging of US equities as well. So that's probably exacerbated the dollar weakness story. But
we've also seen it a bit on the, you know, if you're a big global bond manager, you're seeing again some flows coming away from treasuries into other sovereigns, again just from a dollar perspective. So you know, that all goes to weakening dollar further. So it's, you know, we haven't really seen this for some time. So it's quite an interesting period for us to sit in. You know, for us, we don't, you know, typically we won't actively hedge currencies because we have businesses in the portfolio, company exposure in the portfolios with lots of revenue streams in different currencies. It's very hard to hedge completely. But also, you know, even if you're investing in the UK, you know, 80% of earnings or just less than that are coming from overseas. So you've got to think about so many other aspects, and it has been a question raised certainly from my clients is, you know, do we think there's going to be further dollar weakness and should we be doing something about it? I think, you know, the natural thing or the easiest thing is to be slightly underweight US if you have that view, because that's a slight dollar position, but we wouldn't usually actively hedge. It's, you know, currencies are very difficult to call and have been historically, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, the rate of change in the dollar in the last three months is about as high as it's been, i.e. It's fallen as fast in a three-month period of time as it's ever done. And typically, when that's happened before, it does tend to get a bit of a bounce back.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You'd be pretty brave shorting the dollar again here, expecting further 100%. Meaningful weakness in the short term. But, you know, that, go back to the point, that kind of US exceptionalism is being called into question by lots of people. So I just thought it was really interesting. That is all sort of part of the geopolitics, the J.D. Vance Munich speech, you know, the tariffs, the putting up the barriers to the world, the kind of, you know, turning away immigration, etc., etc. It's very anti-global from the US, and that it's part of a MAGA policy, I guess, from the president, and that's what he got voted
in. And what do you think about, again, a question some clients have been asking is, you know, questioning the dollar as the reserve currency status?
I think we're miles away from that being undermined. I mean, just because the dollar goes down doesn't mean that the dollar isn't the reserve currency. The dollar's gone down meaningfully before and remained
correct.
The reserve currency. Yeah. So those two things can be true at the same time.
I think the other, you know, the other point or the other way to look at it is there has to be a real challenger as well, and there's just not.
No.
So, you know, we're certainly in the camp of, yes, there is dollar weakness, but it's still an exceptionally, you know, the US economy is still exceptionally strong and the strongest economy in the world. It's dynamic. It's still full of some seriously good businesses that aren't going to change overnight. Mm. So there's lots still going for it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And then talking about sort of American exceptionalism, I've got this chart I borrowed earlier from a colleague, the weighting of the Magnificent Seven in the US equity market as a proportion, and Nvidia is now 7.6%, Microsoft is 7% of the index, Apple is nearly 6%, Amazon 4.5%, Google 4%, Meta 3%, Tesla 2%. Between the seven stocks, they make up 33% of the US equity market, which has flatlined and actually fell a little bit in the first half of the year. It's recovered, but it was really weak through January, February, March. It's recovered a little bit. And actually, if we, but just kind of goes to show on a 10-year view, these stocks were only 13% of the index 10 years ago, and they're now 33. So they have, you know, gone on an absolute tear. Same way of looking at the same story, but
they suffered more from the tariffs, didn't they? They were the ones that fell the most.
Yeah. Well, as we discussed in April, when we did record a pod just around the time, you know, Apple is definitely the stock that's in the crosshairs of tariffs. And then this is a sort of chart just shows the Magnificent Seven relative to US equities. So when this line is going up, that means that the Mag Seven are outperforming the US, and when this line's going down, they're underperforming. So we can see, you know, from January through April, the Mag Seven were underperforming, and they have bounced back a bit, to be fair. We've had some good earnings reports.
Well, I was gonna say that it's, you know, part of this isn't just momentum and you know, people piling in again for no reason. We have had some really good numbers again.
Yeah, Microsoft in particular had a really strong set of numbers, and actually the Microsoft numbers in April were one of the kind of catalysts for the wider market to bounce back. And people, you know, that AI trade was being questioned, and Microsoft came out with very strong growth in their cloud computing and AI division. Yeah. So that was just settled nerves a little bit.
And Nvidia as well, which really looked at is, you know, they had pretty awesome numbers.
It's really key to the AI story, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the Mag 7 not quite, you know, firing as well as it has been, but certainly not been terrible so far this year. But it's just a sort of an interesting, you're right, US equities remain pretty expensive. but not, you know, not too expensive. Just a couple of charts on the economics. Inflation, I mean, a lot of the UK inflation figures here in blue have popped up to 3.4. Everyone sensible that I listen to and speak to suggests it's a bit of an anomaly caused by the sort of April upgrading in prices and energy price caps and that stuff. So that should unwind as the year goes on. But US and European inflation continue to moderate, and we should expect rates. We've got a chart here on interest rates. It's just UK and US here. Rates should moderate as the year goes by. I don't think this is a particularly good forum for discussing whether Jay Powell should listen to Donald Trump and cut rates, but the president is essentially tweeting at Jay Powell every day, calling him an idiot for not cutting rates. So huge political pressure on Powell at the moment. But ultimately,
and how long's Powell got left on his term?
He's got about a year left, isn't he, before he is finishing his term. He won't be reappointed. I don't think he can be anyway, because he's done three terms. So Trump gets to choose someone else who might be more amenable to listening to him. But I think in the short term, fundamentally, Powell is absolutely right to stay on pause, because the economy is doing fine.
Yeah, for sure.
And the tariff uncertainty is still there, so we don't know how that's going to play out yet.
Yeah.
UK, there's
how many cuts are being priced in for the rest of the year? Is it still two, or has it gone to
two
one
more
now?
Two more for the UK. The committee is split, which is refreshing. If you're all thinking the same, then no one's thinking at all. That's what I always think. There should be a few more cuts, but we've got the one kind of worry that I've got on the UK. Hang on, Alex, not that one. This one here, unemployment in the UK, which is the blue line, is going higher, and some of the UK labour market stuff is looking a bit wobbly.
Do you think some of that is tariff related and companies are scared to make too many investments? They're just cutting back slightly?
I think the whole uncertainty factor, and I think the whole blinded by the headlines, national insurance rises, headlines, the general sort of doom and gloom, the confidence problem, as I think I've called it historically in the past.
I mean, in the UK, people pretty negative about the autumn budget, aren't they?
Yep. And, you know, generally speaking, it looks like Rachel Reeves, you know, she can't get a few billion shaved off the benefits bill, and therefore she's going to have to come back for tax rises in the autumn, which is not what anyone wants. And yeah, so there's a little bit more doom and gloom around.
Rumour last week was she was on her way out.
Well, I know. I don't think she is, but
no.
We did have a wobble in the gilt market last week, didn't we? So I think there's probably fundamentally the UK. Actually, as I said before, the UK economy actually looks okay. Households are in pretty good position, and wages are growing, but the labour market, this is the whole kind of just needs to get going a bit.
But this is what central bankers will absolutely be focused on, won't they? Is on the unemployment data.
Yep. And on that, we've got US weekly non-farm payrolls, so the number of jobs being created in the US month on month. I've taken out the start of the pandemic because it's a huge negative number, but we can like payrolls month on month are running at 100 to 150,000, which is fine. They are a little bit slower than where they were in 2023, but not meaningfully so. So whilst the US labour market continues to produce, you know, I've called it US labour market solid, and until it cracks again, this comes back to the point the Fed are not really in a position to cut rates.
No.
Because the economy is doing fine. But this is also good news for companies, because if people have got jobs and people are getting pay rises,
yeah, for sure,
they're going to go buy some stuff on Amazon and keep their Netflix subscription going. So, I mean, fundamentally, there's nothing really here too concerning. Our friends at TS Lombard have just put this chart together, which I saw yesterday, which I've just borrowed. The US tariff rate on all imports has historically been 1% to 2%, and it's currently gone to 6%. So tariffs are bringing in revenue, and prices, therefore, we think will probably go up a little bit later in the year as that all feeds through, because ultimately someone's got to pay the tariffs.
I mean, this is, again, why, you know, Powell sitting where he is, you know, making the right decision at the moment. Trump can tweet all he likes, but you know, there is, you know, increases in pricing, solid labour market data. There is no reason to cut.
Right.
And actually, you know, paying savers for having cash on accounts isn't a bad thing.
No,
it's
no, agree. And we don't. I mean, the tariff stories. Saw some news yesterday, didn't we, about letters being issued by the president to Japan and South Africa and Vietnam, etc. You know, there's been some outline framework agreements announced. Not many, though. This tariff thing is probably going to drag on for a while, but ultimately, tariff rates in the US are going to be higher across the board. So,
well, he said, he did issue the letters, but he said actually nothing comes into effect until 1st of August, didn't he? And there's plenty of time to negotiate still. So,
and that'll be postponed again, so it'll always be pushed out.
It will.
So I think we're probably, unfortunately, stuck in a bit of tariff news limbo, aren't we? And we're all going to get a bit fatigued. We're all bored of it. But it is important because it ultimately impacts inflation from a macro perspective, but it also impacts companies. Yeah. And if you're Walmart buying a load of toys from China or wherever, or you're bringing in semiconductors from Taiwan, it matters what tariff rate you're paying.
I mean, it does feel we've had an awful lot of kind of quite scary news, and the market's right to focus on that, and it always will do. You know, whatever's noisiest, the market will focus on. But I think, as you said, we're a bit bored of it, so now the market's going back to, oh, actually, what are business fundamentals doing? What are earnings looking like? What's revenue doing? You know, what's the labour market looking like? And we're sort of going back to the sensible stuff again.
Yep.
Which I think is largely why the market has done what it's done, because, you know, we've seen earnings and you know, we've been through another earnings season and everything looks fine. There's nothing, as you say, there's nothing to worry about at the moment from that point of view.
Well, the earnings season for Q2 starts presumably this week with the banks. It's usually the first week, isn't it? JP Morgan, Bank of America, normally report on a Friday, so that'll probably be this Friday.
Will, our financials analyst, is going to be getting ready, having some sleepless nights again.
He's getting himself psyched for that. So whilst the tariffs do impact fundamentals, and therefore that's why it's worth watching, but the fundamentals remain okay at the moment because we've probably not seen the impact of tariffs, plus they've been postponed and delayed and pushed forward. Yep. I don't know, it's going to be with us for a while, I'm afraid, the old tariff story. And then the other sort of big political story out of the States has been the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, if I can get that right. Can't say that without smirking. And that was passed last week, and that essentially extends the tax cuts that Trump brought in 2017, which were due to expire. And there's been a few other changes as well. The net result is that US debt to GDP, which is the yellow line here on this chart, continues to go higher because they continue to have a deficit year on year. And lots of people are beginning to question, we need to get our debt, not least Elon Musk. Yeah. He thinks it's mad that they're spending more money and the deficit's as wide as it is. Yeah. And if you look at this chart here, you know, this line can't keep going up forever. It's an interesting one. The UK is in a somewhat precarious situation on a debt to GDP basis, but not as bad. And the UK figure is supposed to fall during this parliament, so it's supposed to be on a trajectory of falling debt to GDP. Whether that transpires or not is up to the Chancellor and whatever happens to her. But the US line is solidly going higher, and there are lots of fiscal hawks in Washington and beyond who are worried about it. Yes. But seemingly not Donald Trump.
No. And where's Japan? Japan's
250 in Japan, which is a whole other story altogether. But, you know, leading that into bond yields, and, you know, we've been broadly positive on bond yields as investments. You know, the government, the UK government, the US government are going to pay you the best part of 4.5% a year to borrow your money for 10 years. You've got some inflation risk, sure, and the risk that yields could go higher, but that's, compared to what you've been used to, that's pretty respectable, isn't it? So the market is demanding a higher price.
But based on the worry out there, you know, the bond market, there have been a couple of days where there's been some real wobbles, but in the main, it's been fairly okay. I think, you know, we're often asked, what does that debt to GDP number need to get to before we have to panic? And there is, you know, there is no answer to that. No. The answer is, you know, but basically we won't know there's an issue until there is, because buyers will just not buy US or UK debt at some point, and that's when there will be a problem. You know, whether that's 150%, 200%, 250%, you know, we don't know. But all the time governments can issue, they will probably keep going. Of course, on the flip side, if yields do start to rise, it's costing governments more and more to finance.
And they're absolutely incentivised to keep them down.
Yeah, exactly that. So, you know, at the moment it's still workable, but the deficits do need to be addressed, and that's why, you know, Musk has launched his new party.
That's very exciting. But yeah, no, you're right. It doesn't matter until it matters, I think, ultimately. And I think I was reading something yesterday about, you know, in the 70s in the UK, it wasn't until we went to the IMF that we actually properly took an axe to government spending because it got out of control.
Yeah, yeah.
And up until that, we muddled through. And there's some quite strong parallels where we are today. You know, you're trying to get rid of the winter fuel payment, or you're trying to get you know, a couple of billion shaved off the welfare bill, which is already set to grow by tens of billions anyway. If you can't do that, then what chance do you really stand of getting this number down materially? So I think it's probably one of those things that worries people and clients quite meaningfully, actually, when you think about it, you put it all together. But we saw last Wednesday, it was pretty fascinating when Starmer, you know, he didn't, in Parliament, he didn't kind of give his whole backing to Rachel Reeves, and we saw, I wouldn't say a run on the pound, but we certainly saw massive wobble in gilts and sterling that afternoon, until he had to come out and you know, give her the full support later that evening and the next day. So it can be anything. It doesn't need to be anything particularly meaningful.
I mean, I think, you know, the thing that is quite, you know, what has happened is, sort of, if we go back to financial crisis, you know, corporates and private individuals were in a mess and there was lots of debt. That's almost just shifted onto the government. And then there's been lots of money printed. You know, if you go to COVID, particularly in the US, there were massive handouts. Actually, individuals and companies have become extraordinarily wealthy, and
really
the
debt
profiles are much better.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, the government debt profiles look horrific.
Yeah.
So you've just had a shift of wealth or cash from
that's
governments to corporates and private individuals. So
particularly the pandemic, if you think about it, you know, the government writing checks and doing furlough
basically
meant that they took on the debt, not private companies and households.
Yeah.
So households and corporate debt looks really, really, really solid.
It does. I mean, you know, and there's an argument to say, well, the government is now taxing us all more to get some of that money back again.
Yeah. Congratulations.
So it's all a big circle, isn't it? But at the moment, individuals and companies are in really good shape.
But I think, you know, government bonds, as we've seen during this quarter, actually, government bonds have done okay.
Yep.
They have served a purpose in portfolios during the wobbles in April. They did hold their value. They did have portfolios, as we discussed at the start. And we don't think those properties are necessarily totally undermined.
No, I think, you know, we think about duration, you know, the length of our debt in our portfolios very carefully. You know, at the long end, there has been more volatility, but at the shorter ends, you know, bonds are doing exactly what we want them to do. And I think, you know, that positioning is really important.
Particularly those tax-efficient short dated
bonds. It's done clients a big favour.
Yeah, continues to be a no-brainer.
Mm.
A few of the charts, I can't remember what else I've got in here.
Some commodity stuff. Oh, here we
commercial
go.
Property is in blue. This is the UK REITs. Again, just gone nowhere. And commodities, also gone nowhere. I've got an oil price, actually. Let's start with that. So the oil price is here in blue, and the gold price is in gold. So the oil price was broadly quite weak through April, May, really weak. And that's always a bit of a concern, because oil tends to sort of normally dance around to how the economy's doing.
Yeah.
The economy's doing well, the oil price is going well. But obviously we've got that massive spike in June caused by Israel and Iran all kicking off, and threats around the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah.
That's unwound, isn't it? And that seems to have gone quiet.
Unwound quickly.
Has gone around quickly. So the oil price is, you know, broadly $70, down from 75 at the start of the year. Again, you know, if we're thinking about it from us in the UK and filling our cars up with petrol, well, it's fallen more than that, because sterling's up as well. So in sterling terms, the oil price is down even more. So again, that helps on the inflation side of things.
It does.
and it gives people more money if they're spending less money filling their cars up and their energy bills go down. But again, I mean, hugely volatile time for oil price.
I mean, I think actually we would have seen a much bigger oil price movement if it wasn't for sort of the change in supply on a global basis, that the US is the largest producer of oil now and is the swing factor. I think, you know, OPEC does not have the same power or control as it had. And I suspect that oil price would have gone, you know, historically would have been a lot more volatile, probably gone higher if it wasn't for the knowledge of what the US can do. So, you know, that is a benefit again.
And I'm bringing it slightly closer to home. The other big story in the oil market, well, not the oil market, the oil sector, was the story of a possible bid for BP by Shell 10 days ago, which I thought was fascinating. It was quickly denied. Maurizio was on BBC News. Did you see that? BBC Breakfast?
He was. He was excellent.
He's our other Italian. We seem to be surrounded by Italian colleagues. Maurizio, I mean, English is his second language, but I watched his interview on BBC News about the story, and he was very good. I thought he was excellent. It's been denied. Shell haven't bid for BP, but certainly there's no smoke without fire with those stories, right?
Although BP have now, they've got a new non-exec director, haven't they, which is the ex-Shell CFO?
Yeah, he's ex-Shell anyway.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, all that.
I mean, there's been rumours of this tie-up for years.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes, you know, it does make sense.
They do complement each other in terms of their assets.
They really do, yeah.
And there's some synergies there. And then I guess the star of the show this year really has been gold. So January through April, the gold price went from $2,600 to $3,400. Was that a lot? 25% or something. And it's flatlined, to be fair, since April. But it's been the one asset, you know, it really has kind of shone, pun intended. But it sort of settled down a little bit in the last few months.
We can take 10% off for sterling.
Take 10% off for sterling, yes. It's not done quite as well in sterling terms, but it's still been a good asset.
It's been,
And I have put Bitcoin on here, but that's done pretty well as well. All-time highs. So, broad commodities.
And what's been driving gold price?
It's that dollar story, isn't it? And the US and tariffs and geopolitics and
rush
wars,
to safety.
Tariffs.
There's been a lot of retail buying. I think also it's been quite a lot of central bank buying, which continues because of what's happened to Russia. They don't want, you know, certain countries don't want their assets frozen. You know, if they were to be switched off from the SWIFT system, for example, that would be a real issue. So having gold provides some protection. So I think lessons learned from that.
Yeah, no, definitely. But I mean, broadly speaking, the clients I've spoken to in the last few weeks, since this all settled down a bit, have all been, oh, thank you, you've done a really good job. The portfolio's up. I'm amazed considering what's happened. And everyone's sort of looking around the world and going, what on earth's going on? My portfolio's up. So never underestimate the ability of companies to continue to flourish despite the backdrop.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, as you imagine, when, you know, these events happen, we have, you know, lots of detailed discussions and, you know, we raise lots of questions and, you know, question positioning in portfolios, what should we be doing? And, you know, we go back to fundamentals, which is the companies were in good shape. It was very difficult to price what the tariffs would mean if they came through in full force. You know, our instinct was that was a starting point from a negotiation and, you know, we've held position and that's been the right thing. But, you know, communicating that to clients has been really important, and there have been some tricky phone calls, but you've got to stay the course.
Yeah, the reversal in fortunes between the US equity market and everything else has been the thing that's really struck me.
Yeah.
Well, we were sat here at the end of, or the start of this year, talking about last year, thinking, well, the only thing you need to do is buy US equities. And, you know, you're almost an idiot if you haven't got it all in the S&P. Yeah. But 6 months later,
it's a different
story. Thank goodness we do. We are diversified and we've got money outside.
Yeah, for sure.
The US, and we've got money in Europe, emerging markets, because they do, you know, zig and zag and eggs and baskets and all those kind of cliches that we trot out the whole time. It really has been the case this year.
And actually, emerging markets have, considering the tariff volatility, have held up very well, actually.
Yeah.
I know a weaker dollar is often, or has historically been, very helpful for EM because, on a historical basis, debt was often issued in dollars, but that's less of the case now, but still a weaker dollar does help.
Yeah, takes the pressure off.
It does, and actually it's been, you know, they've not really been spoken about, but they've been quietly doing a reasonable job. Certainly have their place in portfolios.
Well, it's a lot more of a diverse index and investable universe than it used to be. The biggest country is now India, which is very, you know, much different than the traditional emerging markets, sort of commodity-based countries and Brazil, etc. So they have done okay, for sure. But I think that's probably a wrap, isn't it, on the first half of the year?
Exhausting. I think so, yeah. I haven't got anything else. Say it's very pleased with the end result, considering what's been thrown at us.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And hopefully the second half of the year will be a bit quieter.
That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Quite like the excitement there, don't we? I mean, we like the juice.
We live for it.
Got any holiday plans, Yuzi? Where are you going?
Family holiday to Cyprus this Sunday.
Very good.
So, we're there for 10 days, so can't wait for that. Bit of time off. We've been for the last 4 years, I think.
Mm. Same place as last year?
Same place. From home.
Olympic Resort or something, was it? No.
Almira. Yeah. That's lovely.
High end for Yuzi. we're off to Corfu.
2.5 star.
The week after, so.
Where are you going?
Corfu.
Are you?
Yeah. Week
that'd
after.
Be good.
So that'd be nice.
Very good.
A few other little trips. Thinking about trying to go to Australia next Easter to see my sister, so we're trying to get organised.
No skiing then?
Possibly. Well, we'll see. TBC.
I'll get it organised. I'll book for us.
Good. With that, we will bring it to a close. Thank you, everyone, for watching and listening today. And any questions, let us know. James.Hughes@QuiltAchievia.com and I am Jonathan.Raymond@QuiltAchievia.com. And we hope to see you next time. Thanks very much.
Thank you.